You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
We are greatly honored today to have the opportunity of a statesman's forum with the Honorable Kevin Rudd, the Minister for Foreign Affairs of Australia. Kevin Rudd was appointed Foreign Minister in September of 2010. Prior to that, he served as Australia's 26th Prime Minister from 2007 to 2010. He led the Australian Labor Party to victory at that time. Prior to that, he served in the House of Representatives since 1998. Before that, he had been the Director General of the Queensland Prime Minister's Office. He gained his Bachelor of Arts with first-class honours from the Australian National University, my alma mater. He was then appointed to the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs as a career diplomat. Kevin, you may not know this, but I was refused entry to the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs, so... That's where our biographies parted. served in the Australian embassies in Stockholm and Beijing, particularly Beijing. Kevin is known for his mastery of not just of the language, but the politics of China. Sitting next to him on the podium this morning is Bruce Jones, who is the director of our Managing Global Order project here at Brookings, and also the director of the Center on International Cooperation at New York University. And Bruce is joining us to have a conversation with the foreign minister, who is going to provide us with, I think, a very important perspective from down under on events in Asia. I think that's particularly important because we benefit greatly from the Australian perspective on world affairs, particularly that part of the world which has become so important to the United States. So we're very grateful to have him speak to us today. I'm particularly grateful because I can for once understand what he has to say, to have an Australian up here. Since I come from Australia and Bruce comes from Canada originally, so it's an all Commonwealth event this morning. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming to the Statesman's Forum the Honourable Kevin Rudd.
Thank you very much, Martin, for that very kind and warm welcome. To Bruce Jones and to Kim Beazley, Australia's ambassador to the United States. I also see Michael Thorley, our former ambassador, here as well. Friends one and all, and I see many friends in the audience who I've known in various capacities over the years. It's an honour to be back in Washington as the Foreign Minister of Australia. It's an honour to be in Washington in a week where America walks tall in the world. You've reminded us again this week of America's reach and capability in a difficult and dangerous world. But equally, we're reminded of a time when the city came under terrorist attack nearly a decade ago. It reminds us of the pain that has been suffered by the families of those who have been the victims of terrorist attack, for whom we hope that the events of the last 36 hours offer some closure. The events of this week also remind us of our common resolve as democracies to deploy the formidable resources we have between us against those who seek to destroy our freedoms. And our watchword, as always, must be eternal vigilance. It's also an honour to be back here at Brookings. I spoke here just 3 years ago. If a week is a long time in politics, 3 years, I've discovered, is an eternity. The three intervening years have been something of a roller coaster ride for the world economy, for global politics, as well as for some of us personally, all of which, as they say in the classics, can be enormously character building. In the global economy, we have travelled the road from boom to bust to uncertain recovery. Over these 3 years, we've worked intimately with the United States through the councils of the G20 to prevent a global recession catapulting itself into a full-grown global depression. Together, we are now working within the framework of the French presidency of the G20 to deal with the macroeconomic challenges of global fiscal imbalance on the one hand and currency valuations on the other. Through the Financial Stability Board, under the policy direction of the G20, we're also systematically working our way through global financial regulatory reform to prevent a repeat of the global financial crisis which brought us almost to our collective economic knees only a year or two ago. At the same time, in global politics, we are witnessing the tectonic shifts occurring right now across the Middle East. Much of the Arab world is now being convulsed by a series of political, economic, and social shocks. The trajectory of these events remains uncertain. The strategic and economic impacts arising from these developments are profound. The future of the democratic project in the Arab world, the influence of Iran, the peace process between the Israelis and the Palestinians and the wider Arab world, the outflow of peoples from the Middle East to safer havens elsewhere in the world, the risk of rising extremism and terrorism, not to mention the price of oil. In responding to these challenges, Australia is deeply engaged with the United States and with our friends and partners in Europe and the Middle East, because we see our interests and our values in Australia deeply at stake in these developments. In the Asia Pacific, we've been confronted by a series of natural disasters, which have brought us face to face with the inadequacy of our regional counter-disaster management capabilities, as well as a critical debate on the future of the safety of civil nuclear facilities across the world. Developments of the political, economic, and strategic level in our region may have thankfully been less dramatic than in other regions in the world, but they have been no less significant. The rise and rise of China continues to preoccupy the region, as does increasingly the rise of India. The irresponsible, retrograde, and reckless behaviour of the North Koreans continues to represent a strategic tinderbox for all of us. Tensions over the East China Sea and the South China Sea have risen. Russia has reasserted its territorial claims over Japan's northern territories. The Taiwan Straits remains mercifully stable, although the stability that we see now remains hostage to Taiwanese domestic electoral processes in the year ahead. In the wider region, there is the hardy perennial of India, Pakistan, and Kashmir. For those of us, therefore, who are engaged in the craft of foreign policy, security policy, and global economic policy, we are in fact living out the oft-quoted Chinese curse, for indeed we are living in exceptionally interesting times. Australia views all of this from the perspective of a middle power with both global and regional interests. We are the 12th or 13th largest economy in the world. We're the fourth largest economy in Asia after China, Japan, and India. We're also one of the world's most significant suppliers of energy and raw materials which power the global economy. In terms of defence expenditure, we are currently number 14 in the world. We are the fifth largest in Asia. If we were a European state, when it comes to defence outlays, we would come in at number 5 after France, the UK, Germany, and Italy. Our defence outlays are currently about one half that of the entire German Bundeswehr. We've doubled our development budget over the last 5 years, and our plan is to double it again by 2015. We have a sophisticated higher education sector, with many of our universities ranking in the world's top 100. We also have one of the most multicultural, yet cohesive societies in the world, a strength which has enabled us to engage comfortably across most of the regions around the globe. Together also with your nation, America, we are one of the oldest continuing democracies in the world, and we are deeply committed to the extension of democratic values across the world. The cornerstone of Australia's global and regional engagement is, of course, our alliance with the United States. Originating in the darkest days of the Second World War and cemented with the signing in 1951 of the Australia-New Zealand-United States Treaty, ANZUS, our formal alliance has endured for 60 years across 12 US presidents, Republican and Democrat, 12 Australian Prime Ministers, Conservative and Labor. It is, therefore, one of America's oldest alliances. And for Australia, it remains the bedrock of our national security. Australia is also a founding member of the UN, and we are together engaged in the full range of UN and Bretton Woods institutions. On nuclear non-proliferation and disarmament, we've been among the world's most active drivers in the conclusion of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, the negotiation of the Chemical Weapons Convention. And I come to Washington from Berlin, where I've just participated in the first formal meeting of what is called the NPDI, the Non-Proliferation Disarmament Initiative, which is co-chaired by Australia and Japan. This is an initiative which brings together 10 significant countries from around the world, including Germany, as I said before, Japan, Australia and others, with diverse affiliations but with the single objective of advancing the implementation of the NPT Review Conference recommendations concluded last year. Right now, Australia also is engaged as part of the combined NATO-ISAF operation in Afghanistan, where we are among the top 10 military contributors and the largest non-NATO contributor. We are not militarily engaged in Libya, although Australia is the third largest contributor to humanitarian assistance to that country after the US and the EU. And later this week, Australia will attend, together with Secretary of State Clinton and others, the next meeting of the International Contact Group on Libya, meeting in Rome. And Australia remains deeply engaged in the Middle East peace process as a long-standing friend of Israel back to 1948 and with good relations now with the Palestinian Authority. In the Asia-Pacific region, the region that is central to our interests, Australia is profoundly engaged both bilaterally and multilaterally. Australia is a founding member of APEC, founding member of the ASEAN Regional Forum, and of the ADMM Plus, the East Asia Summit, and we're now members also of ASEM. And there'll be a test later for who can recite the full renditions of each of those acronyms, and a prize at the door. Australia and New Zealand have now concluded a free trade agreement with ASEAN, combining a total free trade area of 623 million people with a combined economy of 3.5 trillion. At a political security level, Australia is working towards establishing regular 2+2 meetings, that is of foreign defence ministers, with Japan, Indonesia, prospectively Korea. And we've also elevated our foreign and security policy dialogue with India within the framework of the Australia-India Strategic Partnership, which we agreed in New Delhi in 2009. We too have expanded our defence and security policy and military-to-military engagement with China. In the South Pacific, where Australia has particular responsibilities, we currently deliver half of all global ODA to the 14 Pacific Island countries. This amounts to around $1.1 billion in 2010-11 and represents 25% of Australia's total ODA. Australia has also begun a new policy engagement with Africa, where our companies now have $25 billion plus of FDI, actual and proposed, and more than 600 mining projects spread across 43 African states. We now have memoranda of understanding with both the African Union and the Arab League. We're also increasingly engaged with the dynamic economies of Latin America, where our corporate engagement is increasing. Ours, therefore, by definition, must be an activist foreign policy, reflective of our values and our interests, and expressed both globally and regionally. As a nation whose origin lies in large part in the West, but whose geopolitical and geoeconomic circumstances are shaped in large part by our location in the East, there is no alternative other than to be activists, both globally and regionally. This is the inescapable expression of the Australian condition. The 21st century will be the first in several hundred years where the transatlantic axis will not be the most crucial in the global discourse. That will shift to the Trans-Pacific as the geostrategic, geopolitical and geoeconomic centre of gravity migrates from Europe to Asia, from the Atlantic to the Pacific. Teddy Roosevelt said back in 1903 that, and I quote him, "the Atlantic era is now at the height of its development and must soon exhaust the resources in its command. The Pacific era, destined to be the greatest of all, is just at its dawn." Teddy, once again, was well ahead of his time. Asia is now home to 3.8 billion people, over half the world's population. By 2030, wider East Asia may account for 40% of global GDP, compared with only 22% back in 1990. Of course, the dominant chapter in this unfolding narrative is the People's Republic of China. According to the IMF, the Chinese economy will have grown 25-fold over the 25 years to 2015. To put this into context, Australia and China had economies of comparable size back in 1990. By 2016, China's economy will be seven times the size of Australia's. The IMF predicts that in purchasing power parity, PPP terms, China's economy will surpass that of the United States by 2016. And in current price terms, China may well become the largest economy in the world by 2030. These trends are reflected in the respective rates of economic growth. In the 5 years from 2005 to 2010, the US economy grew and accumulated 5%, the Eurozone by 4%, the Japanese economy by 2%, India by 47%, China by a staggering 69%. These economic trends are also reflected in regional military expenditure. Over the past 20 years, East Asian military expenditure grew by nearly 150% to nearly $215 billion. During the same period of time, US military expenditure grew by 36% to $687 billion. By contrast, Chinese military expenditure grew by nearly 600% over the same period. East Asia, therefore, is rapidly becoming something of a global arms bazaar, with China a dominant driver within it. And all of this on top of the long list of unresolved territorial disputes and associated political restrictions that I referred to before. But my core geostrategic and geoeconomic point is this. Continued regional and global economic growth will depend on maintaining for the next 40 years the sort of strategic stability in the East that we have seen over the last 40 years. And this will not be an easy thing to do. This in turn gives rise to the core question of the future directions of Chinese strategic, economic and foreign policies and how the region and the US and its allies and the world at large respond. From the perspective of Beijing, the rise of China looks different to the way it looks from the rest of the world. Think for a moment, you're in Beijing. From Beijing's perspective, China is at last resuming its proper place in the global community of nations, denied it for the last 150 years. Anyone who ignores the importance of Chinese national historiography in shaping current Chinese policy debates is missing a very large part of the picture. These are the factors, for example, which also shape the absolute imperative of maintaining Chinese national unity and the priority of defeating any separatist movements, be they in Xinjiang, Tibet, or in Taiwan. Beyond this, again from Beijing's perspective, their principal challenges are seen as domestic and economic, sustaining sufficiently high levels of economic growth to continue to lift its people out of poverty and to develop its vastly underdeveloped and impoverished interior. Maintaining strong employment growth for the country's still burgeoning population is therefore fundamental. Feeding this economic growth, given China's deficiency in domestically sourced energy and resources, is therefore also a core driver of Chinese international policy. China is now increasingly seized to the imperatives, too, of environmental pollution in general and climate change in particular for its own future economic and social stability, leaving aside any sense China may have of its global responsibilities. China also attaches a fundamental priority to maintaining domestic political stability within its restrictive framework of a one-party state. Tiananmen in 1989 has left a searing impression on the current generation of Chinese political leaders, hence their reaction to any migration of the sentiments associated with the current Arab Spring. China also sees itself as strategically hemmed in, with long-standing historical disputes with many of its neighbours, combined with the forward deployment of US forces in the Western Pacific. The beginning of wisdom, including foreign policy wisdom, lies in understanding, therefore, something of how the other party views reality. China, as seen from other parts of the world, is seen, of course, through a different lens. Many in the region and across the world at large are concerned that China is a non-status quo power. Many sense an increasing Chinese foreign and security policy assertiveness, both within the region and beyond. Many of China's neighbours are functioning democracies of one form or another, whereas China is not and states that it has no intention of becoming one. Despite improvements in human rights over the last 30 years, instances of repression continue to occur and are characterised by a number of celebrated individual cases. While Chinese economic growth is welcomed across the world, particularly in current global economic circumstances, Concerns continue to be expressed about Chinese practices in restricting market access, in not respecting copyright and patent, and about the enforceability and impartiality of Chinese commercial law. In Africa, concerns are mounting in relation to China's energy and resource diplomacy and a predisposition to use Chinese rather than local labour in major resource projects. There is also a wider debate concerning allegations of Chinese mercantilism, particularly in relation to the valuation of its currency. And finally, there are anxieties across many countries about the rapid rise of China's military outlays. In the absence of what Wang Jisi described in the most recent edition of Foreign Affairs magazine as a declared grand strategy for China, a strategy which would be capable of providing for the region and the world a framework for understanding the purposes for which China is accumulating such formidable military assets. As I said before, the world is viewed quite differently from Beijing and from beyond Beijing. The reality undoubtedly lies somewhere in between these worlds of differing perceptions. The key question is how this can best be managed for the long-term future without undermining strategic stability and the economic prosperity that has been built on it. 3 years ago, I delivered a speech at Peking University, which outlined, for Australia at least, the beginnings of a conceptual framework for engaging China. I explained our desire to form a particular type of friendship with China, known by the Chinese word zhengyou, the type of candid relationship that you can have based on true friendship, a friendship that allows the acknowledgement of where differences and disagreements may lie, but still within the framework of real friendship and partnership. I also set out my understanding that the Australia-China relationship was a case of the glass being considerably more than half full, rather than one that was half empty. 12 months ago, I delivered another address, the Morrison Lecture at the Australian National University in Canberra. In that address, I sought to take the concept of zhengyou one step further by calling on the world to free itself of Cold War paradigms in engaging the China of the 21st century. Both in China and many parts of the West, I argue that the arid dichotomy between being characterised as either pro-Chinese or anti-Chinese, or in Chinese being Qinzhong or Fanzhong, had to be consigned to history. Instead, I argued for a new third way of engagement which emphasised both bilaterally and multilaterally what we had in common with China, committing ourselves to further developing these areas of common agreement while not resiling from real differences where they existed. I also argue that these concepts of zhengyou, or a particular friendship based on candour, and a third way in dealing with China, the China of the future, could also be accommodated and articulated through China's own philosophical traditions. For example, when China's leadership talks about a harmonious society, 和谐世界, or 和谐社会, at home, and a harmonious world abroad, 和谐世界, these concepts lend themselves readily to Bob Zelick's framework of China as a responsible global stakeholder. That is a China which helps construct a harmonious global order by contributing to and abiding by the rules of that global order. Rules that not only enhance China's own interests, but contribute to global public goods as well. This conceptual framework, in large part drawn from China's own tradition, represents, I believe, a useful framework for collectively engaging the China of the future, always recognising the positive while refusing to ignore the negatives when they do in fact arise. The question arises as to how such a framework for engaging China can be given institutional shape and form in the future. As our European friends have learnt from their better experience across the centuries, we need to develop the mechanisms and habits of cooperation to preserve our sense of collective or common security in East Asia. The truth is that our wider region has no such institution at present. But in Southeast Asia, ASEAN has led us some of the way. In the 1970s, this region of 10 countries was riven by strife. 35 years later, ASEAN has brought a degree of regional trust, peace and development that was unimaginable back then. It has achieved a genuine common understanding of security across what remain 10 vastly different political entities. What we now need is to expand this sense of common security understanding to the wider region of East Asia. Last year's Hanoi Summit made us focus on our region's architecture and the need to expand the East Asia Summit to include the United States and also Russia, so that we have an institution comprising for the first time all the key players of our region, especially the United States, China, Japan and India, but also the Republic of Korea, Australia, Indonesia and the other countries of ASEAN. And so that we have now an institution with a mandate to cooperate on the full range of political, security and economic challenges confronting the region. And so that we now have an institution meeting at summit level that is capable of making strategic decisions for the region's future. This indeed was the core objective in Australia proposing the concept of an Asia-Pacific community back in 2008. At last, the broader region now has a forum with the right membership and the right mandate to deliver on that objective. Now we need to work on strengthening this new institution's agenda.